We have a young sister with no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day when one speaks for her? Which would be typically what we would consider when a woman of any age gets married, her husband takes over, speaks on her behalf when there's some question about what she would be saying about some matter to do with her current occupation or that sort of thing, her business. Her husband is able to speak on her behalf so that she doesn't have to speak. It's not that she, has to be silent. That's not the point. But somebody speaks for her is a help for her. She doesn't have to speak for herself if she's married. But so this is a very interesting scripture. There's no other scripture that I can think of anywhere in the Bible like this, speaking about the size of a female's breasts. So it's certainly worth consideration here. That was from Song of Songs, chapter 8, verse 8. The number 8 being the hourglass shape number, which is also the feminine shape. So it's also rather ordained by some divine power when the numbers give us this insight into the meaning of things as well. And so this, in this case, was the Ward Green translation, but the verse numbers would be the same in any translation virtually. And this translation of mine is from 2003. Little children, that's our daily scripture for today. I don't think we have enough time today to talk about all the things I want to talk about. We didn't finish yesterday's paragraph, and we have a nice, there's no word for it, that's why I can't say it. But we have a it didn't start with the letter N. I don't know what the word was. It's a word referring to a large number of things to talk about. We have a, I don't think nice covers it. We have a naturally large amount of information. Maybe it should be called unnaturally large, but it's naturally large because it's just talking about the truth as far as we've ascertained, and the truth and all the facts associated with the truth of the chronology and, in this case, Noah's Ark. But the 2268 number we saw already in earlier recent studies relates to from the Born and Raised article. I think it was chapter 11, paragraph 12. Does that sound right? But it was in the Born and Raised article where we talked about the number phi, P-H-I, it's spelled. If you search that, you'll find it in that article, Born and Raised. But the phi number in the Born and Raised article, that phi number can be obtained by using this number 2268 in a way that is explained there. Because 2268 is 63 times 36. And if I go into all that now, we'll run out of time more quickly. But it's possible to say, 6.30 times 360 is equal to 2268. 6.30 divided by 2 pi to the power of 360 is equal to a number very close to 5 plus 1. And we could obtain the number phi almost within 16 parts per million is what it is, of the number phi used in the Great Pyramid, which is not the exact geometrical number phi, but it's close. It's instead of 1.618, it's 1.617 something. 1.6178, I think, and so on. I think it's close to 1.618 to a very high degree, anyway. A few parts per thousand or per 10,000 or something. It's very close to the number phi. what we can obtain by just calculating using this 2268 number, but also the number 2268 is 2 years different from the year 2270 given in the Sumerian King List article, which I was looking for here. Here it is, Sargon of Akkad. ...2270 is what they gave in the Wikipedia article for the Akkadian Empire. And now that I've just mentioned it, I better save this article. Let's make this thing smaller. Let's make the text small enough that we can see it all on one page. Now let's export this. If I don't export this, you know what's going to happen if I don't export this? I'm going to have a problem because I may have already exported it, but there, it's gone. It's done. I wanted to export it because I want to be able to verify this fact later that that's what it said. Okay, so 2270 is only 2 years different from what we say here for Sargon year one based on the calculation we just did from 2141, adding up the reigns of two of the kings, etc. So all this information here leads to a dynasty of Akkad of 127 years, as calculated at the end of this paragraph, chapter 3, verse 10. I want to start paragraph 11. See, it's not that Christians as a whole do not think that science is useful. It's just that some sciences have been, on the whole, more reliable than other sciences were, and science is generally wrong and continually advancing. Now we're finished paragraph 310. Let's go on, and we have, at the end of this paragraph and the beginning of the next one, we have this picture of the solar annular solar eclipse in 2774 BCE. And look where it passes. This is the map, right, of the continent of Europe and Africa and Asia, and we see Turkey here. This eclipse passes over this point of the eastern border of Turkey, which we can see that that is the border of Turkey if we look at a few other things, such as this map. We see Turkey extends past the eastern border of the Black Sea, which is above it in the map. So this is where the arc is, right in the middle of the eastern border of Turkey. From our earlier map in this article, we see that the border of Turkey is shown here, and the arc is right in the middle of that eastern border. So right here, the eastern border is to the east of the eastern border of Black Sea. Right here is where the eclipse passes exactly over that location, the arc site. And in fact, it does. When you look in this program that I used here, Solex by Aldo Vitagliano, I found this eclipse, but look, we're going to talk about that hopefully if we get there today, if we get far enough. Because the reason it's so important is because it's an eclipse on the first day of the Egyptian calendar, Thoth 1, July 18th, 2774 BCE. But not only that, it's synchronized with the heliacal rise of the Dog Star, the star Sothis. That's unbelievably a lot of things happening. If it were purely by chance, it's pretty unbelievable that the first world empire was Egypt. So, I mean, obviously it was by chance, but the point is the calendar day being coincident is not by chance, because the calendar was established by men, right? It's not by chance that the first world empire was Egypt, followed by Assyria and Babylon. Oh, I'd like to take 10 days to discuss this paragraph. But also I want to talk about battery technology, and that would take, like, I was thinking like 17 days we could talk about batteries. I don't know where that number came from. We could talk about battery technology, lead acid battery technology, for a long time. And I don't have a chance to do that because there's no time to do that today, but I want to do that. And I just got a new battery today. I didn't get it today. I got it yesterday, but I mean, it's being trickle charged today. I'm floating it at a float voltage of 13.2 volts, which for some technologies wouldn't be enough to float, probably. a battery of a lead acid, but this is an AGM battery. You can float it as low as 13.2 volts. AGM battery, so I'm kind of happy now to be a member of the family of the Optima batteries owners. So I'm getting an Optima battery charger also, and I know I can probably just charge it using my Corad power supply, using voltage limit and current limit. I can current limit it to whatever I want, 1 amp or 2 amps. If I don't want the current to exceed a certain level, this power supply can limit the current to any number, you know. And also, I was limiting the voltage to 13.2 right now in the floating stage after I charged it at about 14.4 volts. But I didn't let the current exceed... the maximum you could ever get with this power supply is 5 amps anyway. But I didn't let it exceed... I didn't have a limit, I guess, but it was more like 2 amps I was looking at charging it at, basically. But it may have exceeded it at some point. No, I don't think I ever let it... I probably didn't even let it exceed 2 amps. I'm trying to think. What was the 4-amp charger? I was using a 4-amp charger on my other battery that was dead. But that 4-amp charger doesn't do AGM batteries, so I wasn't using that one. Didn't touch this new battery with anything so far other than the power supply, which I control very closely with regard to voltages and currents. And it can't provide more than 5 amps, so there's no way of harming the battery. And the temperature didn't go above 73 or 74 at the most degrees Fahrenheit. So it was very well controlled, but it was a brand new battery with 12.39 volts on it, which should have been 12.8 if it were fully charged, or 12.7. 12.7 or 8 is what it's supposed to be fully charged. So 12.39 tells me it's not fully charged. I have to charge it, and it makes a big difference if it's not fully charged. So that's why I was charging it, but I'm now floating it for the rest of the charge, and the current dropped below 0.27 amps yesterday, and now it's below 0.174. It's about 0.171 the last time I looked, the current, and that's at 13.2 volts. So it's got to go more based on the fact. Well, I want to talk about battery technology so much because lead acid batteries, it doesn't follow Ohm's law. The electrical laws are not, they're broken because it's chemical as well as electrical happening at the same time. You're charging it chemically. So it doesn't follow Ohm's law. So you can't measure internal resistance using Ohm's law. It's got an apparent internal resistance of 0.68 ohms right now, but that's based on the wrong idea. You know, it's using Ohm's law when there's a chemical resistance as well as an electrical resistance. So an effective resistance of 0.68 is not valid. The only way to test the internal resistance, and by the way, my battery tester said 2.48 milliohms for the internal resistance, but my battery tester is not designed to measure AGM battery, so I'm not sure. And it gave me 1150 or 1140 something, 1140 cold cranking amps is the measurement, which is, since it's just an EUTIL battery tester designed for, I don't know what, but it's designed for lead acid, I think, but not necessarily for AGM, so I'm not sure if that's meaningful. But the spec on the battery I got, which is the Red Top 35 model, which fits my Honda Accord, it's got to be the right size, you have to make sure the size fits when you do this, but the model that I got is specced out at 3 milliohms internal resistance. So I measured less than 3 milliohms, but it wasn't fully charged, so it can't be right, I don't think, based on that. But see, that's why I want to get the proper charger from that's made by Optima. So I have to wait for that to arrive now. Well, in the meantime, I'm trickle charging it at the float voltage, which is much lower, and you can you can charge at that voltage, but it takes a long time to do it at that voltage. I just don't want to damage the battery at all. When I was charging at 14.4 volts, I charged it until the current stopped dropping and started to rise. As soon as it started to rise again, it was about something like 1 point something, I think, at the time. I was waiting for it to drop below 1 amp, right? But it never got below 1 amp. When I was charging at 14.4 volts with my CORAD power supply, it's telling me what the current is as well as the voltage. It was regulating the voltage and the current. And the current was limited to 2 amps, but it went below some number, 1 point something, and then it started to rise again. It might have been 1.7, I can't remember. But when the current started to rise again, and I may have been overly cautious, but I said, no, it's got to keep falling. And if it started to rise, then I said, stop that. So I stopped charging it, and I did some testing. And then I started charging it again at the float voltage. So I'm being very cautious until I get the proper charger for it. But I'm not even sure the proper charger would be as cautious as I am. But I need the proper charger to do the test to tell me whether it's fully charged, or I need something. So I'm getting another tester also. But I mean, that's why I say I could talk about this for weeks and weeks, because this is a whole new technology for me. I've had lead-acid battery technology, but now I'm going into AGM battery technology. And I'd like to explain that as saying that the difference between AGM, absorbent glass mat, and flooded lead-acid, they're both lead-acid, but the AGM doesn't have any liquid in it. It's all absorbed by the glass mat, so you can't spill any lead acid or any acid. You can't spill the sulfuric acid accidentally by breaking the container, because there isn't anything to spill in an AGM. So it's much safer. They're more vibration resistant. So I'm moving to a new technology, and the battery I had before was flooded, and even though there was no sign of any foul play, but the other indication is I left it out all summer without bringing it in the house anymore like I was doing. And the heat is what kills batteries, too. And we had a hot summer. Part of the summer was very hot. I think that could have accelerated the demise of my former battery, which is a power something, PowerPoint, I think it's called. Anyway, it was about $170-some, $100 before tax, that I paid 4 years and 9 months ago. So it lasted me a good period of time, and it was 700 cold cranking amps. The new one is 720 for the red top. So a lot of things to think about with batteries, the way more than you ever want to. And getting a new lead acid battery is like, well, it's not, I'm sure it's nothing like having a new child born in your house, but it certainly is very, very intense in terms of all the things you do. The things I did in the one day since I got it already, I've been down there in the basement many, many times checking on it and learning about it. It's a very important thing, or person. If it were a person, it would be very important, but it's not a person. But I'm thinking about I have some concerns I have to deal with. To do with the battery contact, which I won't get into today because it's got to do with the car, not the battery, and the physical contact that the car makes with the battery. It's not solid like it was, like it used to be. Like it over time they loosen up. On the positive terminal, the contact is not as positive, so that might make me inclined to leave it out there during the winter time, right? But that's, I'm not sure. They do well in the cold weather, but I don't know how well they do in the freezing cold weather for the AGMs. And I don't know. There's nothing to freeze, maybe. But there would be. Even though it's absorbed into the glass mat, I don't think you want it to get cold. But the way you protect a lead acid in the winter is you keep it charged up. But I've been keeping my batteries in the house. Oh, yeah, the new AGM battery is lighter weight, too. It weighs about 6 pounds less than the flooded. So that'll be a lot easier to carry, although they're both very heavy. But easier to carry it into the house, and if I do drop it, it's not going to shatter and leak fluid everywhere. If it does shatter, it won't leak. It's not leakable. So there's some safety issues with AGM that make them better. But see, there's so many issues with car batteries. And the new lithium car batteries, the new electric cars, they use standard car batteries in them. Which is, I find that's frustrating, extremely ridiculous that the new electric cars use these same batteries we're using now in the cars. So we're going to have the same problem of replacing those batteries just like we did before. Because they don't just use the battery that's built into the electric car. They use these other smaller batteries. And I have no idea why they do that. But so we're going to talk about the world empire of history today, which was Egypt, followed by Assyria and Babylon, then Medo-Persia and Greece together. I'm sorry, the Medes and the Persians together, and then Greece was a separate kingdom under Alexander the Great, right, when it began. Then Rome, right, became a world power after Alexander. And, of course, one of the huge... The first emperor of Rome was Augustus, right? But he was one of the big emperors. And there was Julius Caesar and so on. But Rome took over at some arbitrary point, I guess, which we haven't well defined here. Took over from Greece, and then there was the dual world power of the United Kingdom, or Britain, and the United States together. Today, they're the world power, or they have been up till now anyway. But Egypt was followed by Assyria and Babylon. So, and that's a brief and essential overview of the post-Diluvian world. Egypt was first, right? Begun by Narmer, or Nimrod, as he may also be called, and Menes is possibly the same person. The Tower of Menes, it's sometimes called, instead of the Tower of Nimrod or Tower of Babel. As it followed from its beginning down to the present day, this world empire followed a sequence which is little questioned and well understood. So basically everybody knows this sequence. The Babylon referred to is that of Nebuchadnezzar himself. That's the Neo-Babylonian Empire. It's called from about 604, but even from 625 BCE, when the father of Nebuchadnezzar, Nabopolassar, was ruling. And Assyria was the kingdom that, of course, preceded Babylon in that list above, right? And that was the kingdom begun by Ninus, or maybe even the earlier power that was exercised by Sargon the Great of Akkad, whom we just talked about, 2268 BCE, roughly. Although we sometimes date him to 2299, around 2300, where the Egyptian world empire ended. And the Assyrian one began is not immediately apparent. And some people date Sargon to 2334, year one. But as Nimrod is Narmer and an Egyptian, so Egypt's empire made a start by Nimrod. Shem, the blessed son of Noah, died in 2780 BCE, as he lived after the birth of Arpakshad 500 years. And at this time, Arpakshad, the son of Shem, became surviving family head. That is, providing that both of Shem's brothers were dead. We don't know when Shem's brothers died because they weren't recorded in the Bible the way that Shem's family and descendants were. As we said above, the entire company moved to Shinar about 2772 BCE. And Genesis 11:2 says they came from the east, in quotes, from the east, end quote. As Mr. Smith says in his book on page 320, such direction, Mr. Smith is a famous publisher or writer on the ancient history. We see his works frequently quoted. Maybe we've got some examples in the footnotes for this chapter. But certainly we've seen Mr. Smith quoted in our articles numerous times. I'm looking for it here. I don't see it there. Let's see. Okay, well, we can look that up some other time because we don't really have time here. But from the east might mean, okay, moving from the east and ending up southward and eastward, right? Which could be the same thing as would be achieved by following the bed of the Euphrates River, Mr. Smith says. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The Euphrates River runs from sort of here. It's this the river near Antioch on this map here. It runs from the northwest toward the east here. They would arrive at the area of Babylon by traveling along the bank of that river. That would appear to make sense to a large degree, wouldn't it? Now still, is there an event that sparked a move from Nazar, Nazar being the landing site of the Ark? Much interest has been shown in the date 2773 BCE, since a date of 139 CE was established as a true rising of Sothis. That was recorded by somebody, right? Censorinus, I think it was, but we've seen that before. This event occurs on the first of the Egyptian month Thoth, only once in 1460 years by our calendar, enabling the next, or the Julian calendar, for example, enabling the next earliest such year to be calculated as 1322 BCE. Prior to 139, you add 139 plus 1322 and you get 1461, but there's no zero year, so it's actually 1460. Then add another 1460 to the 1322 and you get 2782. You add 1460 to that. No zero year adds an extra year when passing the arrow line. The circle or phoenix of 1460 years varies depending on the exact length of the solar year and is only exact when the solar year is exactly 365 and a quarter days for the observer, right? Which is, that's how we get 1460, is when the solar year is 365 and a quarter days. Recomputation of the phoenix of 1460 years has resulted, for example, page 40 of Duncan Steele's book, Marking Time, in adjustment for the 2782 BCE date, some making it 2773 BCE. Look how close that is to the 2774 date that we're going to talk about next. But the proposed date 2773 is actually truly 2774 BCE when the zero year is accounted for. That's if they had not accounted for the zero year, that is, it would have been 2774. But either way, we're within 1 year. It's pretty remarkable. When Thoth 1 fell on July 18th in that year 2774, which is something that we can show before we quit for today, we at least better show that. And it's right here in our LEAP calculator. 2774 BCE is shown here as minus 2774, July 18th. We're in the Egyptian time zone. It's a Friday, and it's Thoth 1. That's the date in the Egyptian calendar. So July 18th is, in fact, Thoth 1. And it's a Friday, by the way, with its different import, or possible interesting import. When the zero year is accounted for, it would have been 2774. But that's only if they had not accounted for the zero year, missing, being a non-entity. When Thoth 1 fell July 18th, though, in 2774, that's verifiable using our calculator now, but back at the time of this article, we used the Almagest calculator. We don't have to consider that because we're using our own LEAP now, LEAP calculator. So it really is July 18th. We've proven it. in more than one way, but it's Thoth 1 in the Egyptian calendar, so that's telling us something, that there was an eclipse on Thoth 1 at the Ark site in that year. But how unlikely is that? A truly incredible and remarkable thing now occurs, because in our searching, and at that time I hadn't even searched for the eclipse, so at that time, in my searching for an eclipse in the year 2774 BCE on July 18th, I just thought of searching for an eclipse because I was in the habit. I was in the habit of searching for eclipses at the time. And beyond our wildest imaginings, a solar eclipse is found in the exact location of Noah's Ark, Yüzengili, Turkey, at that date and time. It's a full annular eclipse at 10:40 hours GMT. That's Greenwich time. We'd have to correct it, right, by moving it by about 3 hours to get to Yüzengili. It's July 18th, 2774 BCE. It happened early afternoon. That was the picture, the illustration. Where is it? There it is. This is the one passing over in minus 2773 is the scientific representation of 2774 BCE. It's minus 2773. July 18th is the date. And this is the path of the eclipse over the site of the Ark. We found it using this program, Solex 10.2. It happened in early afternoon, 13:37 hours local time. My notebook entries, book 27, page 21, 21:12 hours, 2011, January 22nd. By the way, it was January 15th, 2020, when I bought my previous car battery, the one that just went kaput. The longitude of the arc is 44.234 6048 degrees, and with 1 hour added for every 15 degrees further east, the difference is calculated as some 2 hours 56 minutes and 56 seconds after Greenwich Mean Time. A perfect annular eclipse at Noah's Ark is what it is, and it occurred on a Friday, July 18th. It's perfectly annular. It's not a total eclipse. It's annular. It's perfectly aligned annular. July 18th, 2774, so there's a slight ring of the sun, 2774 BCE, the first day of Thoth, Egypt's calendar. This synchronizes all of Egypt's history to Thoth's rising. I can't think of a more important chronological discovery, but our time is up for today, and I wish someone would say something stupid about it so that some of the excitement would be reduced a little bit. I was so excited, I just wished that something would happen that would show how stupid it all was, because it was too exciting to discover something that was that historically important. It's October 8th, 2024 of the Common Era. It's 1936 hours, North American Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you very much. If I can say my name, I'm Ward Green. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie saying bye for now. Thank you for listening and watching. And I love you very much once again. We'll continue this tomorrow. And that was paragraph chapter 311.